Dr. Navarro, I'm interested to know how and why you first got involved with planetary issues.
In my country, El Salvador, we have a lot of social, ecological, economic and political problems. And one of the things that we have to realize is that our problems are not isolated. Our problems are always interdependent. Starting with pollution, some people in the northern countries consume most of petroleum, you know, gasoline, generate emissions, and changes in climate, you know, the extreme weather events like tornadoes, hurricanes, affect, for example, my country, Hurricane Mitch, I remember in 1998. So you see, ecologically, there is a connection. We cannot solve our problems, environmental problems, if we don't solve them at the worldwide level. You know, that means joining forces with other people in other countries. The political problem is the same. We in El Salvador are sending troops to Iraq. Why? To support Mr. Bush, despite the fact that sending people to Iraq is criminal. I mean, you know, I don't think anybody has the right to kill people anywhere else, but we are doing that. So in order for us in El Salvador not to do that, we have to contribute with other colleagues in other parts of the world to try to stop things like wars. Economies also makes us dependent. You know, if the dollar goes up or goes down, it has a tremendous impact in El Salvador, all these kind of things. So we have to concentrate on global issues because everything in the world is interdependent.
What are the main problems, the main environmental problems that have been faced, particularly in El Salvador? You said that there are really life and death issues there.
Certainly. As a matter of fact, the leading cause of death in El Salvador are infectious respiratory diseases, product of air pollution. And the second cause of death are gastrointestinal diseases, product of pollution of water and food. So in that order, the most dangerous thing people can do in El Salvador is to breathe air, to drink water, and to eat food. Those things kill more people than delinquency, for example, you know, or terrorism or whatever, you know, because it's something that is growing, is present everywhere. The only difference is that they are kind of silent deaths, and that's why sometimes people don't notice. The same happens worldwide. When you hear, for example, in New York that 3,000 people got killed with the September 11 thing, everybody in the world knows. But the very same day, 15,000 people were killed in the world because of diseases related to pollution of air, water, and food. But nobody noticed that. It's not in the news, you know. Sometime, maybe, you know, once in a while it gets in the news, but usually it's not in the news because they are silent deaths. And this is happening in El Salvador, and it happened everywhere. All these problems because of pollution, for example, are much worse than other problems.
Now, El Salvador has quite a large economic debt. You've also talked about the rich countries having a great ecological debt.
Yeah, that's exactly what that means. For example, when somebody consumes oil and somebody else pays the consequences of that, there is an ecological debt. You see, we live in an economic system that is very funny because if I have a factory, you know, if I build a factory, the benefits I privatize, they are mine, but the costs, like pollution, I socialize, you know. And this happens with all the economic system. All the benefits, you know, the goods, like having cars, stereos, all the nice things, they are private. But all the pollution generated in the world that affects climate change, particularly the most vulnerable nations, that's socialized, that's very democratically distributed, you know. And then, of course, a debt is generated. It's like the example you see in textbooks. If I have a factory and I'm polluting, and then you have your clothes in your backyard, and the smoke from a factory, you know, destroys your clothes, it makes it dirty, I have a debt with you, I have to pay. But this is happening at a global scale. So I think there is an ecological debt that the countries of the North owe the countries of the South. But that ecological debt can also be seen in many contexts. For example, urban areas, they owe rural areas because people in rural areas are exploited of the resources in order to satisfy the needs of the big urban centers. And we can talk also about ecological debt from this generation to future generations, you know, because we are new generations will come and they will not have enough water, as let's say our generation or previous generation did. And we also have a debt with the rest of the living system in the planet, because we are also destroying other species. So this ecological debt, I think, is very important concept to discuss, you know, because we only talk about economic debt, but we also should talk about ecological and social debt.
You mentioned the problem of water there. It's likely to become an increasing problem in the next few decades. And the alarming statistic is that the demand for water increases twofold. That's twice as much every 20 years.
Exactly. And when you look, for example, at the world average, we take twice as much water from the aquifers, underground aquifers, than what they get as replenishment. So underground aquifers are running dry. In the United States, the largest aquifer, you take 8 times more as what is being replenished. What happens is that it is a very, very large aquifer, so they haven't gotten into crisis, but sooner or later, there will be a crisis. It's very interesting because when you look at the world resources of water, the largest ones are in an area around Brazil, Paraguay, Argentina. It's called the aquifer Guarani. Very curiously, President Bush said that the Al-Qaedas are meeting over there, that there's, you know, a refugee, a ground shelter for terrorists. What they are trying is to militarize that, because they know that water will be much more strategic than oil. So in the same way that Iraq was invaded, pretending that there were weapons, but what did they find? Oil. The same is gonna happen in South America. They will say that terrorists are over there, they will send military, but what they will find will be water. So water is becoming a very strategic resource. And it's very unfortunate that our economic system wastes so much water that then all countries that don't have enough economic and political or military power, they will not be able to defend their own resources. And this is very scary, because in Latin America, we are like the Middle East in water terms. And I am afraid that that is going to bring us into trouble.
In your country, El Salvador, you've been very involved with conservation over the last few decades. What are people's attitude in El Salvador towards conservation?
In El Salvador, the reality is such that ecological problems are at the same time social problems. The case of water, for example, is not just a theoretical aspect that water is being reduced. Drinkable water, clean water to drink. It is a real fact. Very often in El Salvador, I remember, for example, some 15 years ago, people would call us, our NGO, CESTA, Friends of the Earth, and we would go and help them with a water destruction of a water aquifer and give a press conference and, you know, make noise about it. Now, communities don't call us anymore. They do themselves, because there are so many and people know. You know, and we learn about water problems in the news. Communities come, they go to the street, they stop the traffic, and, you know, generating a big congestion problem, you know, affecting people, protesting because they are not getting the water that they need. So water is becoming a political issue in El Salvador. It's not just an ecological issue. It's a social issue. It's also a political issue. And that is water. We talk about forests, for example, the same thing. A lot of forests are being destroyed. That affects also water and affects also biodiversity. And people are aware of that. But of course, at the same time, people are very interested in making money. You know, some people who have the capacity, of course, corporations. And they don't mind if they destroy resources. So there are fights very often in El Salvador. People who want to destroy resources, people who want to defend their last resources. Because some communities feel, I believe rightly, that they have a right to their own survival, their own water, their own forest, whatever, and then there is this corporation or sometimes the central government who wants to take the water away from them to satisfy somebody else's needs, and then there is a fight. So people in El Salvador are very aware of these ecological problems, and as I said, this is getting us into conflicts, political conflicts.
You mentioned the organization CESTA. You founded that back in 1980 with a specific emphasis on appropriate technology.
Yeah, in those days, the emphasis was more technological, and the question was, what kind of technology is appropriate for El Salvador? If you go to a rural area, perhaps, or because of the social conditions, perhaps medicinal plants might be very appropriate, more than some imported drugs that might be more expensive, or also technologies that don't pollute the air and provide a service. So the idea was more like what kind of technology. But then we realized that the technological dimension is only one side of the coin. And there are several sides to this coin: the social conditions, the ecologic conditions, even the political conditions. We started, for example, CESTA promoting the use of bicycles. We developed a school training people how to assemble bicycles. And we ended up fighting in the legislative assembly with the right-wing politicians. That was not our intention, but we realized that when we want to defend a forest, it's not because biologists don't know what they have to do. They know what they have to do. People know, but why do they want to destroy a forest? Because a big constructing firm wants to make a shopping mall. And who decides that? In the legislative assembly, the laws have been twisted in order to allow big constructing companies to destroy the forest. So we have to fight at the legislative level. So we started with appropriate technology, and we end up most of the time doing national and international work, protesting in parliaments or in demonstrations on international conventions and things like that.
And yet you founded this organization in the middle of a war. What was the impact of the civil war in El Salvador?
Yeah, the impact was really bad. But the organization somehow managed to survive, because it was interesting. We're in the middle of the war, and we show, for example, on TV, how a given company was polluting the river, and then people downstream were fishing, and then the fishes go to the market, and then from the market to all restaurants, including, you know, the most expensive ones. So that made people very scared. When we gave news that a lot of the vegetables had human feces, people were very scared, because everybody eats carrots, you know? And if you eat carrot and, you know, has human feces there, everybody gets scared. So it was very interesting, because the guerrilla forces and the government, they were all looking and listening to what we were saying, because it sounded as something at a different level than the political fight that was taking place in those days. I remember, for example, one day a TV crew came from, I think it was Canada, I don't remember, and they interviewed the government, and they said, you know, that they should talk to us in CESTA. And they interviewed the guerrillas, and they said the same thing, they should talk to us in CESTA, when they wanted to know something about ecology. Because it was something that obviously it affected people. So everybody let us work in those days. But more and more, the corporates felt threatened, Salvadorian corporates and people in the government who support them. So the fight is not ideological, whether, you know, Marxism or not Marxism. It's more like corporations want to make more money, and that affects the resources of some people. So that's where the fight is. It's basically interest in profits.
And after the war in the mid-90s, you had a specific project, a tree planting project, to plant, 75,000 trees. There was a very symbolic aspect to that, wasn't there?
Yeah, the idea was to plant a forest of reconciliation. I remember this saying about the Jews after the Second World War, that they planted trees for the people who were killed. So we tried to do something similar. Tree for every person who was killed, 75,000, and we gave the name Forest of Reconciliation Archbishop Romero. You know, and we had reactions. For example, I remember some people in the left, they say, I don't want my tree to be close to one of the National Guards who are criminal, you know. So we had to say, well, you know, it's true, but after all, trees, you know, are trees. And we had to remember that even the criminals belonging to the National Guard, it was their economic situation that allowed them or put them there. On the other hand, the government was not happy about the name of our Bishop Romero. They thought, even I remember we had a public fight because they said that neither us nor the church was very happy, of course, nor the church had any right to name any part of the Salvadorian city that was a prerogative of the Legislative Assembly. We said, fine, but we name it anyway. And this is our name. I mean, we don't care if it is acknowledged or not acknowledged by the government or not, but that's the name we gave. And now we have another program, because next year, on March 24th, there is going to be 25 years that Archbishop Romero was killed. He was killed by the founder of the Arena Party, who is the party that is still empowering El Salvador, you know. The founder, Mr. Roberto Dawison, ordered the killing of Romero, and now it's going to be 25 years. So we are doing many, many actions, like a lot of theological discussions and seminars and scholars, you know, here and there. But we, in CESTA, we are leading a project to plant 1 million trees on the memory of Archbishop Romero, and planting the trees in all communities, and we have a lot of churches, a lot of schools in that endeavor, you know. It probably will take us more than the year that we had as the limit, because we just didn't find enough seedlings to plant. But even if it takes if it takes us more than a year, we will end up with that 1 million trees, we hope.
You became very involved with environmental causes worldwide because you became the international chairperson of Friends of the Earth. What do you think were the main achievements during your time in that role?
Well, you see, Friends of the Earth International is a very democratic federation, more than other international federation, which means that there are a lot of achievements that are due to the different campaigns. For example, we have a climate change campaign. I could tell you many achievements that they have, but it's more their work. You know, occasionally, like one or twice or three times, maybe I go to an international meeting dealing with climate change. But the same happens with mining. The same happened with the Antarctica issues. The same happened with the international financing institutions. I've been with the World Bank meetings many times. But all the achievements is something that is the result of a collective work of many, many, many campaigners in the world, you know. And achievements have been more like, for example, with the international financing institution, there was a multilateral agreement that we managed to stop the Kyoto Protocol. We have been working a lot for countries to ratify it. You know, the United States doesn't want to ratify it, but other countries do. We have, in many places, there are mines that have been stopped because they were too polluting. There are a lot of achievements around the world, but as I said, it has to do with local campaigners mostly.
You were at the Johannesburg Earth Summit in 2002. In looking at the list of issues there that were covered, do you think that there was really any progress made?
There was little progress, you see. I remember there was something about water that we had to reduce the number of people by the year 2015, I believe. But through economic trade corporation interest, that's the problem. That Johannesburg meeting was hijacked by the corporations. And this is what we are more concerned, because corporations are the ones who are leading the world now. The globalization is led by corporations. Governments, including the United States government, are basically tools from the corporations. You know, you may say that, well, governments do this, the UK government does that, and you know, but really, it is the corporate lobby, international corporate lobby, that decides what to do, and they manage to put the presidents who will be more sympathetic to them. Usually politicians, you know, 90% or more of heads of state are very corporate oriented, and they are supported by corporations. and they are only 4 years, sometimes 8 years when you get a replenishment in the United States. But it is corporations who plan, you know, what's going to happen with oil, what's going to happen with uranium. And this is the problem, that when you try to have something like Kyoto Protocol or Johannesburg Meeting or biodiversity or transgenics, are corporations the one who are setting the agenda? And as I said, governments are giving their power, because governments represent people, so they should have that power. But they are giving the power to corporations. Now it's the World Trade Organization that decides. And corporations have no nationality. They are in Bahamas if they have to be there, or they go to China, or they go to Mexico, or they stay in the United States. Whatever is easier for them, they go, you know, according to where they can make more money. So this is the problem that we are facing, that we are having a world that is corporate ruled. As a matter of fact, Friends of the Earth International has requested the United Nations to have a framework convention on corporate accountability. I think that's extremely important. Because, for example, talking about oil, why there are not that many oil spills in Texas or in Norway as there are in Nigeria, for example? Why? Because in Nigeria, you know, here they follow all possible concerns. They have the, you know, the best technology. But there, the security is not a concern. And if they have to, you know, use less expensive technology, they use. But we should have all over the world the same standards. You know, like if something is bad for somebody in Europe or the United States, it's also bad for somebody in Mexico or in Brazil. So it's very important at the international level to have this framework convention on corporate accountability.
We hear the phrase sustainable development a lot. You said in the past we should actually be talking about a sustainable society.
Right, because sustainability is the ability to sustain. So the question is, what is what we want to sustain? I would like to sustain my community, my country, my region, my planet. That's what I want to sustain. I like to see my planet sustainable. Sustainable planet means that we will always have clean water to drink. We will always have enough energy to satisfy our needs. That we will live in harmony. We will live in peace. So I believe that we have to sustain the societies or the countries, you know, any way you want to put it. Not necessarily the development. Development is something that may be needed in some circumstances, may not be needed in others. The example I always put is, development and the society is like an engine and a boat. The most important thing is to sustain the boat, because that is what the life depends on the sustainability of the boat. Of course, I need a sustainable engine in order to move the boat. But what about when I found, for example, an iceberg? I want to stop the engine. I want to put the engine backwards, even to avoid a collision. What about when I find that climate change is threatening the existence of humanity, you know, as it seems? I would like to stop consumption of oil, reduce it as much as possible, you know. But that is very hard for people who think about development to understand. So I do believe that development has to be considered as a tool. What we really have to sustain is the country, the societies.
What about alternative energy sources? I mean, can things like wind and solar power really contribute more than a fraction to our energy use?
I believe so, you know. Let me give you an example. In my country, we have in our NGO, we have a school where we train people to assemble bicycles and other things. And we wanted to have a second floor. So the suggestion by the engineers was we have to have a air conditioning system, so and so. But then we decided to use what is called as solar architecture. It's a double layer of the upper floor in order to let the hot air to be released and avoid exposure to radiation from the sun. In other words, just by doing the proper architecture, we manage to get away from air conditioning. And it's just knowing what is in the textbooks. It's nothing that, you know, was extremely clever. It's in the textbook. You find a textbook on solar energy and you find out how to do that. So that's an example of reducing an energy load. But usually in these schools, you're not taught that. They tell you, they train you how to calculate the energy load, and then you figure out the air conditioning from there. Sometimes by planting a tree or by putting the proper shades, you reduce the energy load in a building, you know? Likewise, how about if we promote bicycles? Not everywhere. Many places are very dangerous, but then that's where the government has to step in, like having bicycle lanes, separate traffic, all these kind of things. If we convince population to use bicycles, the reduction of oil might be considerable in many parts of the world. But we associate development with cars, so we feel proud we have cars. And cars should be considered as tools. How about how about public transportation? Trains, as you have in Europe, many parts of Latin America, we have no trains. In the United States, there are basically no trains. How about saving energy by properly insulating buildings? You know, cooking. There are many ways to save energy in cooking. So it's not just that we have to replace fossil fuels by energy, by electricity coming from wind or solar. It's a million different ways that we can save, you know, cent by cent, and eventually we make up the whole pound, you know, cent by cent. And this is what I believe, a new energy vision that consider all these small energy aspects that if you put them together, they generate a lot of impact. But also it has to do with consumption. For example, why, if I am in the UK, let's say, why do I have to be eating food from Brazil or fruit? There are a lot of, you know, apples are very good. There are a lot of fruits around here. Likewise, if I am in El Salvador, why do I have to be eating apples from California? If there are a lot of papayas and a lot of pineapples and a lot of fruit there. You see, this has to do a lot with consumption, that we live in a world that promotes consumption, and consumption means energy, you know? And this is where we have also to work a lot to try to reduce consumption levels that are not necessary. In El Salvador, I can live all my life without apples. But in UK, I could perhaps live all my life without papayas, you know? And there are a lot of fruits that I don't even know. But there are a lot of local fruits organically ground. And this is also a movement to try to consume what is grown locally. The problem is sometimes you say, yeah, that's more expensive. You know, sometimes you find apples from California cheaper than local oranges. What happens is that a lot of the costs are subsidized. Oil price is subsidized because you have a price of oil, but all the damage that oil generates, and then you have a hurricane that destroys your house, no part of that damage is included in the cost of the apple. If it were, the apple would be much more expensive. Transportation would be much more expensive. This is what we have to understand. But of course, the economic system forces us to buy cheaper things. But if we can afford it, it's better to buy things that are a little bit more expensive but are locally grown.
You mentioned the image of an iceberg. It sort of reminds me of the sinking of the Titanic, really. There was a dance band playing on the Titanic just before the boat sank. I mean, are we in that kind of position?
Well, you see, the Titanic is a very important image, I believe, because the engines, you know, if they had been run backwards, let's say, you know, 15 minutes before, maybe we wouldn't have the Titanic, the destruction of the Titanic. Likewise, if we try to stop now all this excessive emissions of carbon dioxide, maybe we are not going to have the big problems that you know, seem in the horizon. Now, optimism. I feel problems are extremely bad. However, this is like if you take me, for example, and then drop me, you know, in a helicopter, let's say 5 miles from the coast, you know, what shall I do? If you ask me, will you make it, will you get there or not? I will answer you, I will swim, you know, because I have no alternative, I will swim. I have never swum in my life 5 miles at once. I have swum maybe 1 or 2 kilometers, but I will swim. And maybe I can do it. Even if it is 10 miles, I will swim. You know, you never know. I may find in the way, you know, a boat or even a dolphin, you know, whatever. Or maybe I can swim, you see. This is how I see the problems. We have no alternative but to struggle. I know climate change is extremely, you know, threatening. I know when I see Mr. Bush, you know, and the corporations and all the killing in Iraq. Oh, I said, that's tough. But look, for example, what happened in the old Soviet Union. You know, for good or for bad, it collapsed. And that, you know, like 10 years before, it would have looked as something impossible. But it happened. For good or for bad, you can, you know, question whether it was good or bad, that's another discussion. But the point is that it happened. So I don't see that the situation is impossible. Because if I thought that the situation is impossible, I will just stay, you know, waiting. But I think that the situation can be done. It's very difficult, but it can be done. And if it can be done, we might as well try, because we might perhaps do it.
Dr. Navarro, thank you very much.